Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from this week 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. Now, for those of you who have been following this series, you will be aware that the big story is the crisis in the Near East, as they call it, or the Straits, or Turkey, as perhaps we better know it better. This has calmed down a bit since last week talks are taking place. In the meantime, Andrew Bonar-Law has written to the Times. Now, Andrew Bonar-Law, in case you don't know, has been the leader of the Conservative Party for 10 years, from about 1911, and he was Chancellor of the Exchequer during the First World War. He's recently stepped down, has no position, but things will be looking up for him quite soon before they start looking down quite badly. Anyway, this is the what I think is the interesting part of his letter. He says this, "I see rumours in different newspapers, which I do not credit, that the French representative with the Kemalist forces has encouraged them to make impossible demands. The course of action for our government seems to me clear. We cannot alone act as the policemen of the world. The financial and social condition of this country makes that impossible. It seems to me, therefore, that our duty is to say plainly to our French allies that the position in Constantinople with the Straits is as essential a part of the peace settlement as the arrangement with Germany, and that if they are not prepared to support us there, we shall not be able to bear the burden alone, but shall have no alternative except to imitate the government of the United States and to restrict our attention to the safeguarding of the more immediate interests of the Empire." Well, that's laying it down, shall we say. The big story here is that Britain is not getting any support for action in the Straits area, either from the French or indeed from Canada. This is a fact that has not made the newspaper, or the Times, at least from my reading, it has not made it yet, and will become important later. Anyway, Bonar-Law makes mention of Germany, and all is not good on that front either. Here is a report of a speech made by a chap called Reginald McKenna. McKenna does not tend to feature in most histories these days, which is surprising, given that he had been, First Lord of the Admiralty, Home Secretary, and Chancellor of the Exchequer at various times in recent years. But now he's a banker, and he's talking to fellow bankers in New York. This is what he has to say. "I approach the question solely from the economic point of view, and my endeavour is to determine, so far as I can, the limit of the debtor's capacity to pay, and the effect of payment upon the world's trade." He goes on. "First, let us look at the magnitude of these international debts. The greatest of all is that of Germany for reparations, a debt of which the United States declined to receive any share. The amount was not defined by the Treaty of Versailles, but subsequently by the London Ultimatum it was put at $32 billion, at which amount it stands nominally today." In case those of you have been, or for those attentive listeners, you will remember that last week a sum of £24 billion or £24,000 million was mentioned. This sum is considerably less. It is probably about £8 billion, which is equivalent, which is equivalent to about 2 billion ounces of gold, slightly less maybe. In anyone's money, that's anyone's money, anyone's, whatever, well, whatever it is, by anyone's measure, that's a lot of money. But it's considerably less than the sum I mentioned last week. Anyway, last week it was a soldier doing the estimating, and this week it's a banker, and I think I'll take the banker's word for it. So I'm going for 2 billion ounces of gold. Anyway, here we go. "Of the remaining debts, the liability of France to the United States and Great Britain is $6.5 billion, and of Italy to the same two countries, $4.5 billion. Russia owes these countries $3.5 billion, I laugh. I don't think that's going to be paid. $3.5 billion and a further $1 billion to France. These are the principal debts. The others are comparatively small in amount. He goes on. We have no record in history of international claims of this magnitude. The indemnity exacted by Germany from France under the Treaty of Frankfurt in 1871, in round figures $1 billion, created the largest debt between governments ever known until the recent war, and is the only precedent we have of a considerable international payment. This is interesting because there is an argument, which is sometimes made, that those reparations from France to Germany after 1871 were more onerous than the current ones. I find that hard to believe. I've always found that hard to believe, because even if you factor in the growth of the French economy and the growth of the French population, I don't think you get anywhere near to that $32 billion sum. Anyway, so I'm much more with Reginald McKenna than some other commentators. Anyway, we go on. But what we have to investigate is not Germany's capacity to produce wealth, but her capacity to pay foreign debt. I cannot help thinking that we have here the source of the error into which the Versailles experts seem to have fallen. Nobody has ever doubted Germany's immense power to produce, but production by itself is not enough. She must find a market for her exports, and the problem thus becomes one of determining the possible extension of German export trade. He goes on to explain that there are good reasons to think that Germany might have difficulty in exporting, which from our perspective seems a bit bizarre, but, he's a banker, so he should know. And he goes on to say, the conclusion seems irresistible that Germany has no present capacity to obtain a surplus from the export of goods. Well, that's pretty definitive. Well, if he's true, if he's correct, that's pretty definitive. And probably explains why the reparations issue never really goes away and eventually just gets cancelled. Anyway, of course, one thing that Germany was only too good at exporting was battleships. At the end of the First World War, just about every modern battleship in Germany's possession was exported to Scapa Flow, and then after a suitable interval, scuttled. What happened to that great shield, that marvel of British naval engineering, that reef upon which the Kaiser's dreams of world domination came to grief, otherwise known as the Grand Fleet? Well, that part of it that didn't get sunk got scrapped. Not a single British dreadnought battleship survives, First World War or Second World War. A clue to why this is can be found in this statement issued by the Admiralty on Friday the 6th. It has recently been suggested that in commemoration of the part played by HMS Lion in the Great War, an effort should be made to preserve this famous ship, which is shortly to be broken up. In case you don't know, HMS Lion was a battle cruiser, if you understand that concept, and it was the flagship, the flagship of the battle cruiser squadron in Jutland. It sort of saw a lot of action. It saw a couple of its fellow battlecruisers getting blown up and was almost blown up itself. Anyway, we go on. The Admiralty therefore desire to point out that the Washington Treaty specifically names HMS Lion among the capital ships which must, without fail, be completely scrapped within 18 months of the ratification of the treaty. This fact alone precludes the preservation of HMS Lion as a national relic. Apart from this, the annual cost of maintenance of a ship of her construction in such a state of preservation as to fulfil the purpose desired will be very large. Well, there you go. I mean, if in case you didn't know, the Washington Treaty was signed very recently, and it's an arms control treaty, mainly between the United States, United Kingdom and Japan, which will have all sorts of effects in the 1930s, but, well, spoilers. So that's what that was about. We Brits might not be so good at preserving our battleships, but the Tibetans are having a good old go at preserving their customs, even if some might wonder why they bother. The story here is that there's been an expedition to Everest. It's failed, and one of its members has taken a little detour to Tibet to see what happens there. In a Tibetan city, gruesome customs of the lamas. At the Tibetan New Year is enacted at the temple the annual ceremony of purifying the city of the evils of the outgoing year. The lamas produce a beggar man who is willing through fanaticism and promise of eternal merit to risk his life in the strangest of ceremonies. Naked, he clothes himself in the putrid entrails of animals, with vile bloody intestines coiled around his head, neck, arms and body. He represents the evil, the disease, the ill luck and the bad things of last year. He runs out of the temple door and the mad populace beat drums and blow trumpets to frighten away the devil in him. They hurl stones and beat the beggar with sticks. They chase him through the streets out into the open country if he does not get killed before. It goes on. The most gruesome custom one can see at Gyantse is the disposal of the dead. At daybreak, the body is carried to the crest of a low hill, a mile from the city. After a lama has said prayers and incantations over the naked corpse, the professional butchers slice the body up with knives, cutting off separately the legs and arms, and lastly the head. Rather puts me in mind of the bizarre way that the railways were privatised in the 1990s. Talking of which, there is an article, a number of articles, as there usually is actually, about the railways. But in this, there was it reaches the interesting figure of how many journeys on the railways took place in 1921. The sum being some 1,819 million or 1.8 billion. I thought just for fun, I would see what the corresponding figure was for the last year in, you know, before the COVID just completely wrecked the rail industry, or at least wrecked the vastly reduced the number of passenger journeys there were. Anyway, 2019-2020, there were 1.7 million journeys, or 1.7 billion journeys. So almost exactly the same sum. Today's figure, for completeness, does not include journeys on the London Underground, which are enormous. Whether the London Underground is part of the 1921 figures, I do not know. Although I suspect the numbers are going to be very similar. You have a similar commuter market, I would guess. Maybe there are more journeys these days in London and fewer journeys outside. But that would be my guess. Anyway, we end with, as has almost become the custom, with a story from the Workers' Paradise. The Dickens Danger. The Izvestia, a Russian newspaper, points out that when Zinoviev announced ruthless war against doctors, scientists and men of letters, he overlooked the theatre. The theatre, continues the Moscow newspaper, is the sorest spot of our ideological front. Having declared war without quarter on bourgeois ideology, we cannot remain indifferent spectators, while waves of petty bourgeois poetry pour from the theatre. After continuing for some time in this strain, the Izvestia concludes, "We consider that the moment has come when the cricket on the hearth is more dangerous than any Denikin." For those of you who don't know, The Cricket on the Hearth is a novella by Charles Dickens, and Denikin is the leader of what's left of the White Forces. It goes on, "The Cricket on the Hearth, in a dramatised form, has been a great favourite in both Russian capitals for some years. It has been staged with much success by the Studio Theatre." Anyway, that's enough for this week. I aim to have something up next week.